This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is North South.
Hey, it's Tim Kawakami here. Another episode of the North and South Podcast with my co-host from the Los Angeles Times, Dylan Hernandez. Dylan, how you doing today?
I am okay, I think.
I want the day where Dylan says, I'm doing great. Oh, man, it's fantastic. The world is good. So I guess I don't really say that anyway. But Dylan, we got a lot, as always, things going on. What's on your mind today? What's your first topic on that's bonking around in that head of yours?
Well, I just heard from Jack Harris, our beat writer. He covers the Dodgers for the LA Times, and he called me about some rumor, I guess, that he kind of heard about that was floating around in Japanese media somewhere, that Trevor Bauer might be part of a kind of this traveling team that is going to play against the Dodgers minor league team on one of the backfields. So, yeah, I got on Twitter, thing popped up instantly. And at least according to Sanspo, the plan is for Bauer to pitch three innings for one of these, like, it's one of these teams that kind of consists of former college players, you know, former pros that are kind of looking for like another shot somewhere, you know, go to minor league camp and play in front of these, you know, you get theoretically scouts will be watching and stuff. So that, I guess, is the plan. You know, if that is the case
today,
That would be on the, what is today? The 9th?
Yeah.
This is six. Okay, this is going to be on the 10th. I don't know. Every day feels like Tuesday for me, right?
I know. I just thought it was the 3rd, by the way.
So this will be on the 10th. And yeah. So, what's already kind of a circus-like atmosphere there will undoubtedly, for at least like one day, be more of a circus. But, you know, that said, if Bauer isn't signed by this point, you know, my guess is that this isn't going to happen for him and that he'll probably end up back in Japan and
The Dodgers aren't. I imagine the Dodgers are not signing him.
No, they're not signing him. And again, like I think, just if you're any other team too, and if you kind of had interest, right? My guess is you would have picked him up by now. There are probably some markets, obviously, that would be probably a little bit more forgiving about something like this. And you know, they still haven't picked him up, which I kind of think, you know, at this point, it's kind of getting late in camp. You know, you never want, I think, a pitcher to be out there that long. You know, and I think, you know, I mean, just not to compare, you know, Blake Snell to Trevor Bauer in any way, shape or form. But, you know, the fact that Snell is this far, you know, into camp and still unsigned, I think kind of starts diminishing his value a bit. Right. Because, you know, he's not going to be ready to go opening day and stuff. So, again, I think if you had interest in Bauer and you thought you could pull it off and everybody was kind of OK with all that stuff, it would have happened by now. But it hasn't. So, yeah. So those are the two phone calls I took this morning were about Trevor Bauer. So what's going on in your neck of the neighborhood?
I mean, there's been little burbles of, hey, the Giants certainly have some starting pitching issues. That's part of why the Blake Snell thing continues to be conversation. Hey, would they be interested in Trevor Bauer? My answer was no, they would not. It's just a baggage. It's a complicated situation. I don't even know how good he is anymore. I know he pitched okay in Japan. Right, Japan he pitched right last year.
Yeah.
And it's just not going to happen. You're not, the value of that is beyond what the Giants would do. And I think any team would do. I am interested in continuing into this always very open, no problems at all world that we're in. It's the A's renderings of their theoretical new stadium in Las Vegas. Very Sydney Opera House, if you want to go the high side. Very kind of convoluted, weird little like a bounce house, if you look like to me, just squatted on this tiny piece of land, theoretically, in the Tropicana. Situated the wrong direction, by the way, because it's supposed to go away from the setting sun. And also like pointed towards the direction of Las Vegas. I don't think it can point. No lights. You're going to have lights. Batter's eye. You're going to have batter's eye. No bullpens. Sort of important. No air conditioning ducts. I think you're going to need that. Like, you know, it's an imaginary drawings for an imaginary situation that may or may not ever come true. But Dylan Hernandez, your thoughts on what's going on there? Do you think this is feasible, or do you think this is just one more step in a weird, potentially failed process?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, obviously, you know, this stuff more than I do. And, you know, from the beginning of this, since we started talking about this whole thing, right, I feel you really educated me on this process. And you seem to be right on every step of the way. You know, there are times, right, you know, right, in The Big Short, right, ultimately, the guy says, you know what, I'm betting against that guy, whatever that guy's position is, I'm betting against that. Yep. And that's what this reminds me of, right? It's, and, you know, you talk about all the things missing in that rendering. It just feels like a, you know, a metaphor for the entire thing, kind of, right? I have been to the Sydney Opera House, which I like a lot. I actually thought when I looked at the drawing itself, it kind of looks like the Sydney Opera House. The thing about the Sydney Opera House, though, is that the location is prime. You know, not only, right, is it right on the water right there, but also just around it, you know, there's some restaurants.
The bridge.
The
bridge is right there.
Yeah, and you go up too, and there's this huge public park. You know, kind of botanical gardens type place that just stretches out for what seems forever. If that thing were in the United States, it would cost, you know, easily $30 to get into, free to the public. You know, to me, that's what kind of makes that whole area kind of cool. And, you know, as soon as I transported that drawing into that part of the Las Vegas Strip, which you and I, obviously, we've covered our share of fights. We've been down there before. Not quite the same, right? So, you know, the funny thing about the sun orientation, you know, the Dodgers have had some history with that. Their spring training facility, I can't remember why, but Jamie McCourt wanted it facing a certain way. So you got the sun coming right in, you know, and then I believe the Bakersfield Stadium, right? You know, the longtime Dodgers affiliate there, they had the sun coming right in. So, yeah.
That's not good. That's dangerous. Yeah, that's dangerous. Like, you got 100-mile-per-hour pitches coming at batters, and there's a reason why it's supposed to be oriented away from that in the afternoon when you're, you know, it's glaring anyway. It's just, we'll see. I mean, again, I've always said it's possible for them to do it. It's just every time they say anything, and he did an interview with the San Francisco Chronicle, John Fisher did and said nothing. And it just, even when he pops his head up, you never understand where this is headed, what the next real steps are, if he can do it. In fact, you believe that he can't do it. And I've said over, like, they're farther away from a Las Vegas stadium right now, after finally producing these imaginary renderings, than they were ever with Howard Terminal. Like, Howard Terminal, they were close to a deal. Like, whether it was a good deal or bad deal, they actually were close to a deal. They are not close. They don't have a financing plan. They don't have a construction plan. They don't know what they're playing in between. And I keep saying it is not. They keep saying 2028 is when they're going to move in. I will put whatever amount of money on that being much later in 2028, even if they get this thing done. This is, look at where they are. They're just spinning their wheels with imaginary things that don't make sense. And if those are the things that they push out, what do you think the rest of the thing that they don't talk about? It's a scramble. It's just a mad scramble to try to make it coherent. And these renderings are not going to change any of that. In fact, they build, you know, the idea that they don't have this set up. They can't fit all this on a 9-acre plot. They finally agreed they can't do retractable roof, which is what experts said. You cannot fit all that on a 9-acre plot. Maybe they'll get more land. You know, the whole Bally's thing is, you know, up in the air. I know there's negotiation, but it's like, that's up in the air too. That's, if you keep waiting on that, that could be another delay of a year, another delay of 2 years. Who knows how much costs increase by then? Who knows where John Fisher's head is? So I hate to be the person who just keeps squatting on, you know, this situation, but I've seen this happen over and over again with John Fisher. This is the same thing. In fact, it's worse. It's worse than his stuff. His failures in the Bay Area, because it's a place that doesn't want him. Like, Dylan, like, Las Vegas is almost like a suburb of LA, right? We know that. We've that drive. It's fights when you go, you know, you cover fights. It's just traffic from LA. It is, you know, what, 2.5-hour drive from most parts of LA. If, unless
how fast do you drive? 2.5? How fast do you drive, Tim?
Well, okay, maybe more than that. Maybe more than that. Well, you know, like I just feel like once you're in, you're, yeah. even when you're in Riverside, you're still in L.A. That's why, like, okay, I got to get out of L.A. Once I get out of L.A., it's 2.5 hours. Yeah. Like, obviously, from like downtown L.A., it's more than that. But that's how I feel is I'm still in Riverside. I'm still in L.A. Then all of a sudden, I'm driving to Las Vegas. That's just the way I think of things. It's. Is there going to be any? Well, why would any LA fans want to go to this? Like, what are the what's the base here? What's the population base in Las Vegas for a baseball team?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good question. You know, I think I saw something that like you know close to 40%. I think even of Raiders season ticket holders are from LA. No, you know,
so not, like, not a surprise.
Yeah, or from California, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously some are from Northern California, but mm-hmm. the point is, you got a significant percentage coming from LA. Like you said, right? Those fights, those are LA crowds. I mean, there's a reason, right? All the De La Hoya fights that you covered out there, you know, it was considered a hometown fight for him because everybody was from LA. Yeah. And that's still, from my understanding, that's still a Dodger town. You know, there's a Dodger store out there, you know? So, yeah, that's going to be kind of a tough, you know, the thing is, man, you know, I was just in, you know, the Dodgers are going to be having opening day in Korea. Right. So I had to kind of rush back to Arizona to go do something and kind of driving around. What kind of hit me a little bit was, you know, all the things that Frank McCourt said would happen in that area have actually started to happen now. Now it is, what are we talking about here? That was 2009, you know, so, you know, we're right close to 15 years out from that now. And things are, you know.
What area?
The Glendale, the spring training complex.
Oh, area. Okay. Arizona. Yeah. Okay.
And part of the thing was, hey, we're going to build this thing here and there's going to be all this development afterwards and it's all going to be great. And now it's kind of finally starting to take shape, right? And even, you know, the property that he had in Boston that he ultimately basically swapped for the Dodgers, you know, he had talked about kind of this big shopping development down there, you know, and sure, 20 years after he said it, it happened, right? He just kind of didn't have the money, I think, to kind of wait it out. But the plan itself, these plans weren't that bad. As I'm looking at Fisher here, man, it just looks like these plans just suck. I mean, there's no plan, no vision, you know. And again, anyone who's kind of read me over the years knows by no means am I a Frank McCourt fan. That said, the guy at least had some ideas. This to me is like, I'm
looking there's at your the headline. There's This is your headline, John Fisher, worse than Frank McCourt, like the only owner in the last 100 years who's been kicked out of Major League Baseball. And John Fisher is worse. And I think, you know, again, McCourt was a bad guy doing bad financial stuff. I think that's the legal definition of bad stuff. But John Fisher has no sense. He's not bad, like not doing illegal things or whatever, you know. McCourt was doing. I don't want to be dragged into court here. Whatever he was doing.
I'm not even sure McCourt was really doing something illegal. So basically what he was doing, though, is he was using the team as collateral to get, like, loans to kind of fund his life.
Let me clarify. He was not doing illegal things. Absolutely not.
And I'm guessing it's actually standard, like, American business practices, right? Like, okay. my suspicion is that he got kicked out for doing something probably that a lot of these other owners do, right?
Okay. Well, anyway, he got so kicked out.
About it. Yeah.
We don't need to talk about Frank McCourt, but
I love talking about Frank McCourt.
You do. Clearly you do.
You know, they burned down he bought a soccer team and the fans got so mad that they burned down his practice facility.
Was that in England?
This is in France. He bought Olympique Marseille, which is another traditional team, only French team to ever win a European championship. Mm-hmm. Owner died, kind of similar thing, right? Distressed asset comes in, buys it. First year it went well. The fans were very happy. But then things started going bad. And next thing you know, they showed up, you know, with flares to their practice facility and set it on fire. So John Fisher hasn't done great with our earthquakes.
The earthquakes either. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, everyone's like, why don't they make him sell? They made one guy sell. That was Frank McCourt. I just don't think they have the stomach for doing it. And they like Fisher. I don't think they like McCourt very much. They like Fisher. It's not the Dodgers. It's the A's. Like they think of the A's as an itinerant franchise anyway. Like they just want to get them to a spot. They don't think, you know, what does it really cost them? You know, it's very minor percent of profit. It's just a thing out there they need to get fixed. The Dodgers were the Dodgers. Like they need something major and stable, and they obviously got it with Guggenheim and that whole crew. But the Fisher thing is just not something that they're going to push. No, as Vegas blows up and then John Fisher just throws his arms out, I think MLB will have to write in with a solution. I don't know that they are good at that, but you know, what Mark Davis was somewhat similar to Fisher in that he did not have money to spend. Now, Fisher has money to spend. He just doesn't want to spend it. Mark Davis did not have money to spend. He just doesn't. He's not that kind of guy. He had Jerry Jones walk him through the Vegas process. He had Jerry Jones saying, I will get my company Legends and we will pre-sell all these suites. You will have that cash. We will get you the funding in Las Vegas. They kind of played Marvin Adelson, was thought to be a minority owner, and then they didn't do Marvin Adelson, but he helped grease the wheels, and that's how they got their stadium. And it's Allegiant, obviously, just had the Super Bowl. It's very successful. But that was Jerry Jones. Like, who's the Jerry Jones of MLB? They're doesn't exist, right? That who's the owner that can say, here's the we'll get you through this and we'll make sure this is going to work. If there was a guy like that, it would have happened already, right?
There really isn't. You know, the closest there is to kind of like the, you know, like a consensus builder, so to speak, you know, when Manfred was officially put in as like commissioner, it was like Jerry Reinsdorf was the guy that ultimately kind of went around and collected the votes. But I don't think he's a builder in the way, you know, Jerry Jones is, right? So, yeah, this one's kind of tough, you know. And I think, you know, Guggenheim, again, kind of they were smart the way they went about this, right? It's, you know, they brought in Magic Johnson to kind of be the face of this thing. I mean, people still think Magic Johnson, like, owns the team. Like, he's got, like, nothing to do with this. He never... As soon as the thing was done,
he goes to games.
Yeah, he shows up to like, I mean, he's showed up to fewer and fewer games as time's gone on, you know. But, you know, for the first year, you know, he showed up with, you know, the cover of Sports Illustrated with Matt Kemp. I remember when they first bought the team, right? So he was around at the beginning. He understood that they were smart about the way they went about that, you know. And even if you kind of look at the Dodgers ownership group, you know, between
Peter Goober.
Walter being the money guy. Yeah, Peter Goober being kind of the entertainment guy. You know, Stan Kasten being kind of the guy that's been around Major League Baseball. I do kind of wonder what he actually does, but, you know, seems like he fills a role of some kind. You know, and then Magic Johnson was the face of the entire thing, you know. So, yeah. And you just, again, I kind of look at this this Fisher thing from the outside, and I'm just kind of like, what is he doing? Like, I don't even,
it's ringing.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah. A guy who's got the team who is paralyzed into, you know, not doing the thing that finally can get it over the hump. He just won't do it. And as I wrote before, like, they could have been done at Howard Terminal. They literally could be finishing up the stadium by now if they had kept to the initial plan. Right now, they could have been done if they had done Laney College. They could have been done a lot of other places. Now, A's fans criticize me for not ripping the Giants for blocking them from San Jose, but I was like, I give businesses the right to like exercise what they have, which is the Giants did not want a team in San Jose. I grew up on the peninsula. I understand why you do not want that whole region to be cheering for another team. The A's had the East Bay. Like, I did not criticize Mark Davis for getting the stadium done in Las Vegas. That's where he had to get it done. John Fisher doesn't have even that. He doesn't even have that lined up to do it correctly. I would respect if he did. Like, this is part of business. Business isn't there to please fans. Business there is just to make money. And you please fans, you make money. That part of it he hasn't quite understood. But the idea that, like, you know, I would the Giants have prevented this. The Giants haven't prevented the A's from building anywhere except for San Jose. There's other cities that could have done it. And we've saw them, Howard Terminal, Laney College, up and down, Fremont. And these renderings almost are cartoonish. You know, it's like, you know, it's just, they operate in a universe that does not exist, but so has the entire Las Vegas thing for the A's, the entire thing. You know, the Yankees trotting in there and there's no bullpen. Like, the way I think of the Yankees and the Red Sox, like, this is not how big time teams operate, but John Fisher is the owner.
There's one real small point on the, it's actually not a small point, but the, you know, in terms of the Giants blocking, right? My understanding is that when, you know, because they paid for their own stadium. And part of the financing of that was that, right, the banks basically told them, we loan you the money, but you need to hold on to this territory. So, you know, you can say.
Yeah, I don't know. It was more the Giants got the loan by saying we have this territory. I don't think the banks had any right to tell them what to do. But yes, it was part of that agreement or understanding. And again, I think I come at this, you know, differently than many. I grew up on the peninsula. If there was a team in San Jose, there was a good shot I wouldn't have grown up going to Giants games. I would have gone to a team into the South Bay. That's a pretty rich demographic. It didn't maybe include the Kawakami House when we grew up, was in that rich demographic. But that demographic right there, Burlingame, San Mateo, Palo Alto, like Menlo Park, like this is Hillsborough. Like these are rich areas. Yep. And with lots of people in them, lots of disposable income. And if you give away San Jose, which is just to the south of them, you give away those areas too, in large part. You know, it's like 35% of their ticket base still is from that region. So I just don't like you hold on to it. If you have the right to it, you hold on to it. If you and I had a right to something that's valuable, I wouldn't say, oh, for the good of Dylan Hernandez, Tim, you've got to give him your upstairs bedroom. No, it's my upstairs bedroom. That's what the value of this house is. I don't care the good of Dylan Hernandez when he's coming through town. He can freaking stay in a hotel room. He's not staying at my place. So that's how I, you know, businesses operate to the good of what the business is. So moving from there, Dylan, I know you have a thought. We've been kind of teasing this out. Where the sports media industry business is going. We're talking about business. We're talking about what's good, what, you know, what the customer wants, what fans want. It's been going for a while now, but there definitely are some contortions. I feel it. I can say what I feel. I mean, I'm out of the newspaper business, but I'm watching it and I see newspapers trying to adapt after, you know, what, 20 years too late of resisting, of doing it poorly. It's sad to me. I'm a newspaper guy, but I made that jump, maybe, you know, one of the first waves to do that. You know, like others have done it. I'm not saying I was the first, but like the big wave. And I don't know where newspapers are going. You're at a newspaper, Dylan. I know I don't want you to crap on anything you're a part of, but what do you see just in LA? You see in San Francisco? Where do you see overall where this is going, just for people like us? Like, we care about people like us and what that means for the product and what that means for the readers.
Yeah, you know, I think, right, with both markets, you know, I mean, I even go back to, you know, right, when I was in the Bay Area, just a number of papers that traveled with every team, right? You know, and I go back, again, to when I was, like, in high school and in college, right, when you were at the Times, you know, and, you know, when I even came back, right, you know, after 5 years in San Jose, came back to LA to cover the Dodgers, you know, the Register was traveling, the LA Daily News was traveling. They weren't part of the same chain at that time. You know, Riverside traveled. And I think, you know, like Riverside too is also kind of a big thing in terms of like helping develop younger writers, right? Because, you know, it was a smaller paper. They would take a lot of chances on like younger guys, but it kind of gave those writers the experience to be on a traveling beat. You know, Tyler Kepner, a longtime New York Times baseball writer who's now at The Athletic, right? You know, I think he covered the Angels there. Joe Christensen over in Minnesota was, you know, I think did a stint there. Andy Baggerly. Yeah, Baggerly, you know, for Riverside. And so kind of what you're seeing too is also this, like, these intermediate steps are kind of gone for people in the industry, right? And so now it's almost like, hey, you're either getting hired by the New York Times out of college or like you're out of work. And there's kind of no, you know, fortunately for us, you know, Jack Harris, our, you know, the Dodgers beat writer who I mentioned earlier, was a summer intern for us. He showed a lot of promise. We found a way to kind of keep him on. Now he's covering the Dodgers for us. But, you know, it's kind of tough, right? I mean, again, our first contact with Jack, I guess, my guess is that he was like 20, 21 years old. You know, and it so happened he was the right guy, but, you know, it's not going to always happen that way. So, you know, I think kind of there's been kind of a talent, right? If we're going to be honest, there's been a talent drain in the business. You know, again, with fewer papers covering these teams, traveling with these teams, you have less competition. And I think the lack of competition creates a bit of like complacency on beats, right? Because, you know, you're there, there are two other guys, you know, you're not really, right? If it's not kind of a cat and dogs type situation that maybe, you know, we experienced at some point in our careers, right? I mean, those are the things that kind of force you to kind of dig out that story that they don't want out there, right? You know, because a lot of times when you're out there as a beat guy, you're wondering, you know, is this worth it, right? Is this kind of worth it? And back, you know, there were times when I never really felt this was a choice. you know?
Mm-hmm. Or you had to. It wasn't worth it. You had to.
Yeah. You know, and I think now, you know, when I just kind of like the overall feel that I get, like kind of looking at our media, you know, environment right now is kind of that lack of urgency. You know, Plashkin and I talk about this all the time. I mean, I pulled into Dodger Stadium every single day thinking I was going to get fired, you know, and right. I'm not sure kids have that same fear these days, you know. And again, it's not their, you know, it's not like
we can talk. There are other media platforms out there and, you know, in a differing way, there's blogs, there's, you know, TV stations, although they're pulling back from the journalism, the written journalism a lot. There was a big kind of push for it. I don't know how much they do it anymore. Like, does Bresnahan write very much at all? Or is he a labor writer?
Oh, he's got the best job in the world now.
Yeah.
He's
so, studio. I mean, yeah. So like there isn't writing there, and teams have tried to do it, but they're not really doing a lot of it or doing it successfully. They do it on some levels, but like there's other ways, and I'm not trying to wall it off. Like there are bloggers and there are, you know, YouTubers, and the 49ers have a million of them, and they can be successful. They can be credible in their own way. But I think what you and I are talking about is like the people who go in the locker room, the people who talk to a lot of people, who write things that people might get mad at them about, and then show up the next day and then keep doing it. And, you know, there's a progression. You know, you can go become a columnist, you can become a feature writer. Some people become editors, although, you know, I was an editor for a while and it's not what I want to do. But I just think there's been like a lack of that. Like, we don't see the pipeline for that. Dylan Frank, I was talking to somebody like, Dylan, you're like the youngest guy I know who I can put my fingers like, this is someone who's a columnist kind of grown from this, from the reporting side, from the I'm going to talk to people side. I would love to see Marcus Thompson, obviously, you know, a big part of that. But you know, who are the 27-year-olds who are doing that, who are on that path? I'm sure there are people who could do it. I just don't know that the path is there. And I don't know, I'll flat, you don't have to say this, but I don't know if the newspapers are even going to be there in 5 years. It's like, and maybe this will get aggregated. I'm a newspaper guy. I'll keep saying it. I'm a newspaper guy. I know our initial founder had a quote and that, you know, going to bleed them dry, whatever. I never liked that quote and I don't agree with it. But if you just see it naturally in the Bay Area and in LA, I'll just flat out, there is an opening for something else to happen. And because it's not being provided by the newspapers. Hopefully The Athletic does provide some of it. I don't think all of it's not nearly of it is being provided by The Athletic. Certainly there's the news side and all these other things that The Athletic isn't providing. I just worry about that. And I think the leaders of these newspapers have failed, period. I mean, I would say that to their faces. They failed for 25 years and they're still failing. They don't understand. I have conversations where I was like, you don't know what you're talking about if you think this. And what works in this digital world is different than what worked in 1987. And you see these people who were brought up in 1987 or 1993, or they're just trying to protect their own jobs when their jobs are not necessary or have to be adapted to this and they don't want to. So again, Dylan doesn't need to agree with any of this. I know you're in it, but I do feel strongly about this, that there is a heaviness to what newspapers are doing that should have been, I get it. I understand why. These are good people, but that should have been dropped 15 years ago. You don't need to do, if you are still having the Tuesday meeting for 2 hours to talk about the rest of the week, you're done. Because you know what? The moment you walk out of that door, things have changed. And the moment at 11 p.m. when the editors are asleep and don't care, that's when the big stuff happens. And it has to go up. And writers are writing things and they're posting it without editors. I'm not saying editors are useless. Editors are incredibly important. But the whole process where the editing seems to be in their minds more important than the writing, that's wrong. That's way off. And newspapers should have figured that out 20 years ago. And they still are thinking that way. Dylan is not signed off on all this. I don't want to put Dylan on this. This is the way I think. I'm out of newspapers, but I've been talking, you know, I talk to people about this and tech people and aren't always right, but they are looking at newspapers and like, what are they doing? What are they doing? And I can't explain it because I've been out of it. And The Athletic, certainly The Athletic Bay Area succeeded, very proudly succeeded, because we didn't do any of that stuff. We're not having Tuesday meetings. We're not, you know, broken down to bureaucracy. Now the Athletic's gotten very, very bureaucratic lately. I don't deal with it, but you know, I get the bureaucracy. Media just loves bureaucracy, but you can't do it that way if you're going to have a deep future and you're going to be reacting to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. You just have to. That's partly why we're doing this podcast, right, Dylan? Like, we just have to be part of the next thing. You can't be stuck in the old thing to try to protect somebody's job or 50 people's job. That's what I believe.
Yeah, you got to go where people are, right? Now, I do wonder, is kind of the market just too fragmented now? I, you know, again, I was just in, you know, the Dodgers spring training camp a couple of days ago, had a number of people approach me, you know, telling me, you know, basically our place has gone to shit. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. But like, look, they, but that's the thing. They care enough to say that to me, right? They
about care the LA about Times? About the LA Times or about,
yeah, about the LA Times, you know, they, because they care about the product. And I think that that's great. That's how
it's
they
get that. Man, from when I was there, I mean, I hate when people say this, but from when I was there, it's not even the same product. It's not the same product.
Yeah. I mean, it's not from when I first joined the paper, right? And there was kind of this, again, it was a, even just internally, you know, I remember I would take a day off and, you know, Bill Shaken would come in and, right, fill in for the day, and I'd read his gamer and think like, shit, that's better than anything I've read in the last week. Is the right guy covering this team, you know? And, but that's what kind of made, kept you going for a while, right? Like, you, there was always kind of this fire there. And, you know, the thing is, you know, my kids get all their news on TikTok, you know? My wife, you know, kind of goes through, right? You know, she's watching Spanish language evening news. I mean, so you have this kind of very fragmented market. I do kind of wonder with the online stuff too, right? It's, you know, the hits and the convert, right? The paid subscribers that you get off every story, those are the metrics that are used. And, you know, it does feel like there's a lot of gaps kind of in the coverage now, you know, you know, we didn't have before. I mean, you know, now that Helene Elliott, you know, has retired from our place, so I'm guessing
Hall of Famer.
We're going to have no hockey coverage at this point, or very minimal hockey coverage. You know, this year going forward, we're not covering the Angels, you know. I do think we'll cover the Chargers because of the Harbaugh, you know, Harbaugh being there. We'll give that a shot. I kind of wonder, you know, again, if Harbaugh turns out to not move the needle, wonder where we're going to go there. You know, we obviously, the Times has a, you know, long tradition of excellent boxing writing. We have not had a boxing writer since Lance Pugmire left the beat.
It was really, you know, really good from a little about 3.5 years there, if I remember correctly.
Real quick, I would want to say this, that I think I've told you this, Tim. Tim's book on Oscar De La Hoya, if you have not read it, still worth reading. I think it's held up remarkably well, actually. Right? Well, I mean, we have learned things about Oscar since then, but kind of the core story about who Oscar is, I think, is held up very, very well. One of my favorite sports books. I think I read, I remember I was in my dorm at UCLA, and I think my dad bought it for me. I read it like, I read it like in a day and a half. Like, I think I skipped class. I just read.
Oh my God. What am I doing to people? No, I appreciate it. I mean, it was a little bit against the grain when I wrote it. I will say it, like, Bill Dwyer, sports editor of the LA Times, like, ordered me not to write it. And I said, to hell with that. And so he took me off of boxing. You know,
Bill loved the Oscar.
No, might as well have been his promoter. And I thought he kind of was for a while. But that's fine. You know, I can air out my dirty laundry whenever I want to, but that one I'll never forget ever. But then Oscar, you see Oscar's documentary that recently on HBO? Right, like, Oscar, like, you're rewriting my book, basically. Like, it's just like, you could have said this to me and the book would have been the same. Like, it is amazing. I wanted to actually reach out to Oscar about that. I haven't yet, but it's like, good Lord, Oscar, this is like more than, like, this was from the soul of what that book was starting to say. So, and meanwhile, people are, no, what are you doing that for? He's a great guy. What are you doing that for? And like, this is just the start of the beginning of that interesting, at times tortured, at times fabulous story. No, I appreciate it. Well, we can talk more about that book all you want to.
You and I could probably do like 12 hours on Oscar easily.
We should get Oscar on his podcast. I think I could. We can try to figure that out.
I'm not sure Oscar's happy with you right now.
With you? Well, he hasn't been happy with me.
The last thing I wrote wasn't very flattering, and he's coincidentally canceled on me at the last second, like the last two times.
Dylan. But that's one of those where you write what you got to write, Mm-hmm. Obviously, his camp hated it. They hate, you know, HBO got a copy of the initial manual, one of those, and like they sent it to him. Like, that was, thanks, HBO. Way to go. We appreciate that. Because, you know, the Warner books and all that thing. There was so much weird stuff involved with that book that was fast. I could write a book about the book because so many weird things and the power of HBO and the power of boxing, Bob Arum, and who I get along with, but like he was promoting De La Hoya and they're pulling out all the stops. It wasn't even a bad book. I think you're sympathetic to him, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Is that came out of that, like kind of liking the guy and, you know,
with weaknesses, with flaws, with screwy stuff, but it was this incredible fear of this book. And it's like, I didn't make that much money off of it, but I just wanted to tell the story that I knew. Like, no one else was in position to tell us. And I believe that too. Like, no one since, right? Nobody, except for Oscar himself. Right. There have been books about him, very bad books, that because they weren't there. I was there for these key moments in his life. So, wow, we end up talking about Golden Boy. I don't mind that.
And to that point, by the way, like right now, right as we speak, you know, I don't know. Do you know who Ryan Garcia is?
I see him on Twitter going crazy.
Yeah, so he's kind of gone off the deep end, right? And he's just right. He's kind of, you know, I kind of feel like they've been like these like bad copies of Oscar that have come, right? Like Canelo wasn't quite as good as Oscar, but good looking guy, you know, right? He's got like cement feet, whatever. But like, and then Ryan Garcia is probably another, you know, three steps down for Canelo in terms of like, I'm not really sure this kid can really fight. But again, good looking kid, pretty charismatic. And he's having this like full blown like meltdown right now on social media. Part of me wonders if it's just kind of some cynical, you know, marketing ploy, whatever it is. We're not there right now, right? And again, you know, sort of 20 years ago, we would have been right there. There would have been somebody in position, I'm sure, when all this was said and done, to write a great book, regardless of whatever happens to Ryan Garcia's career. And so, yeah, there are a lot of kind of gaps now, right? I mean, there's going to be, I'm guessing, certain interesting things that happened with the Angels this year that like might in 5 years down the road kind of pay off. I remember, you know, when unfortunately when Tyler Skaggs died, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of by coincidence, you know, the beat writer at the time was a young beat writer. She had a wedding to go to. So Mike DiGiovanna and I are on the road now. We're going out to Texas. And you know, you see the value of, right, DG having covered that beat for 20 years. He knew who to talk to. He knew how to get around and get information and stuff. And, you know, I just kind of think that, you know, I mean, because even all these aggregators at the end of the day have to get their information from somewhere, right?
No question.
And that's the thing, is that this whole ecosystem is dependent on the people on the ground. I've always been a firm believer that the beat guys are really the, you know, the backbone of every sports section. I think that there has also kind of been a bit of this movement to like, right? Beat writing's kind of been devalued. You know, there's so many kids
by editors, because they get off on the bigger stories because they can plan the bigger stories.
Yeah,
they can't plan the beat because the beat just happens. But that's that's the lifeblood. And I'll say this: The Athletic has devalued beat writing in a lot of ways, but hired a lot of beat writers, but prizes these big because they are old media. Old media loves these huge stories that take 7 weeks, and these are often great stories. But what the fan buys the product for is that knowing that the everyday is going to be covered in a strong way. And we have the APSC. Obviously, I can't stand the organization because they reward things that editors plan because they're editors. They don't reward things that happen and someone's on it or someone gives a hint about it and suggests it's going to happen. Then it happens and is all over and tells you why it happened. They want to plan, you know, the magazine story. They're always looking for the SI story. And guess what? SI is almost gone. Like, those are great stories. You can still tell them. I want them to be told. The lifeblood is someone who's there, who's been there for 3 days, who's seen it build up and then is there when it happens and then tells you what happened, why it happened, and then tells you the next day. And yeah, I'll just say the Athletic's gone away from that, and I have told them I am very disappointed that they've done that. But they've done it. You know, it's their decision. I'm not, you know, maybe they can come at me for criticizing that. It's a decision they've made. I think it's very clear it's a decision they've made. And I believe beat writing is the heart of any real sports journalism operation. Has to be. And if you move away from that, then you move away from the heart. So there you go. That's what's going to get me in trouble, Dylan. That one will get me in trouble. Fine. Get me in trouble.
We're all probably screwed in a couple of years anyway.
Absolutely. So, whatever. Yeah. And you know what? Yeah. The fact that we can say these things is means we're going to last longer than a couple of years. That's what I think. And the people who get upset about it probably won't be around a couple of years. I know a couple who already aren't. I'll put it that way, who I clashed with at The Athletic. They're no longer a part of sports journalism because the things move past them and will continue to move past them.
How do you think this affects, you know, again, not having, right? I mean, it's different, right? I do think that, you know, the cameras, for example, right? The cell phone cameras have really kind of affected, reporter subject interactions even. You know, I remember years ago when I was still covering the Dodgers, you know, Don Mattingly and I used to like yell at each other all the time. We actually got along really well, whatever. But like, you know, I remember one of these things that ended up on YouTube and my brother calls me and he's like, man, why are you such a dick? And I was like, no, we actually like, that's how we talk to each other. Right. Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, when a comedian talks about if you weren't in that room, you kind of, right. You don't understand that space. You know, you can't get it. You know, so I do think like, I mean, that's one place where I've noticed that, right. Behavior has changed at all. Changed a bit. I'm just kind of wondering, do you think, you know, the way kind of teams operate now has changed at all because, you know, maybe we're not as on top of them as we used to be?
Well, I'll just say, I mean, part of that is that they want to steer so many things to press conferences.
Right.
I mean, in baseball, it's impossible to have more. I mean, although they're moving toward us, right? It's a press conference. It's not at the locker. It's at your press conference. It's in front of the logo. It's, you know, every TV camera is there and you can't have the human interchange because there's just too many people there. You know, Otani is going to be impossible to do the human interchange. It just is. But that's happened. That's an NFL thing. It really started first happening in NFL. Like the quarterback at his locker is just too much. The quarterback's going to be available at the podium once a week. That's it. There are other, you know, you can have a relationship with guys, but that's when he's available. The head coach available at the podium 3 times a week. That's it. And I think the rest of the sports have kind of looked at it. I go, yeah, that's not bad. Like, let's just do that. Some sports are better suited up for it than others. You know, the Warriors, we used to get Steph at his locker. Now it was really hard. It got really big. And as soon as they signed Durant, then it was just Steph's going to do a presser. Durant's going to do a presser. Clay's going to do a presser. Draymond's going to do a presser. That's the way it's going to be. You can still kind of talk to them. They sure would love us to be out of that locker room, but we fight for it because you can still have human exchanges there. Can't really interview them there because you're not supposed to, but that's where I talked to Durant before he got really mad at me, just chatting with him. And there weren't cell phones there. Like that, those were moments that are precious just with anybody. It's harder, but I do think like if you work hard enough on it to build the relationship, you can have the walk with Curry after a presser. I can do that. Marcus for sure can do that. Talk, you know, make sure you can talk to Kerr. I try to do that, you know, when there's a different kind of question to ask him. You got to work on it though, man. It's hard. And sometimes you don't get it. Sometimes you try and you don't get it. But that's where I think is a differentiator. And that's why I wish I had seen more people doing it or trying to do it. But, you know, they're also the other thing that's been big, I would just say, is the national reporters are given almost every big scoop. They are. They're great reporters, but they're also hooked up with the same agencies that represent the people and the general managers, by the way, and the coaches. So it just happens. And I'm, you know, these are great reporters. I'm not saying they wouldn't get every scoop, but it's kind of predestined that they would. Like, you hear it, like, this scoop is going to go to this reporter because he's hooked up with this agency. And guess what? It goes to that reporter because he's hooked up with that agency. It's all right. And I'll listen. Everybody uses the methods they use. And again, these are great reporters. That's where they get to those spots. But that's changed a lot, right? I mean, people try to ask me all the time, well, why does ESPN break every story? Why does this go? And it's they hire the best reporters, and also it's kind of in the NFL, it's designed to go that way. This is the way it's supposed to go. Now, the critical stuff doesn't always come out that way. Why? Because those sources don't want it out. So you have to be around, you have to be credible, you have to be asking the questions. And sometimes, like the Harbaugh, Jed York, Trent Baalke thing was just me for like 4 months. And just because a lot of people, until the 49ers wanted it out. And then it started coming out. And other great reporters. I mean, fantastic reporters were working on it. I'm not saying, but it was just me for a while. And it was kind of lonely out there for a while. It's like, this is real, guys. Like, this is real. There is a split happening here. But like transactional stuff, that's going to go to the people lined up for it. And we understand it. But that's changed writing, no question. Like, you just, when this happens, it's going to, the big stuff's going to come out through a national thing and not going to come through a local platform. But when it comes out through a local, it's a rarity. It's celebrated. It's great. It's a rarity. So I tend to kind of be around these things because I kind of hear the glimmerings of it. I don't have the actual thing. That's fine. I would love to have the actual thing. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. Most times I don't. But like, I can throw out like, here's what they're thinking. And that's, I think, again, that's pretty valuable stuff. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but it's what they're thinking about. And that leads to the, you know, where are they going? How is it developing? Where does it go next? So I think that's where credible reporters can have a real stake in this, even when the national reporters are getting 98% of the scoops. And they do. And again, let me just say it one more time. They are great reporters. They are fantastic reporters, but it's also kind of met that way. All right, Dylan, we got long on this. I don't know if everyone's lasted through this, but yeah, we have takes on the media industry. I have some other ones too that I won't offer right here. Maybe Dylan does too, maybe not, but it's changing. And I will say, part of my idea to do this specific podcast is that because there aren't many doing it the way I like to do it than the way I think is valuable. And I've told Dylan, you should be bigger. You should be bigger in LA because you're doing it the right way. If you ask me, I always thought Marcus did it the right way and it wasn't always recognized, and now it is. And I'm so happy about that. And Dylan, you should be someone out there that people understand is a voice on so many different topics. And I will stop being nice to you at this moment. I realize this is way too nice. You surprised me with the De La Hoya book stuff.
Looks like we lost Tim. I think his Wi-Fi went out. We might have been too nice for each other, and maybe the servers couldn't handle all of that. But that will be this week's episode. Hopefully, we'll do this again next week. I might be in South Korea with the Dodgers, but we'll definitely make time for this. And you guys will see me maybe from South Korea with Tim next week. So thank you. Bye.